Shabbat Shalom. A little while longer till the bagels. Sorry, it's a lot of talking. No bagels? Let's all go home. I saw bagels downstairs. First of all, thank you to the rabbis and cantors for generously sharing their bima with me. Every time I come back to my home synagogue at Neve Shalom, they give me the opportunity to speak at family smachot, of which there's been very many. This one has been acclaimed as the last bar bat mitzvah. I've been saying one never knows. I can think of all sorts of possibilities. But it is definitely Shechianu Vihigianu. Thank God we've made it here, all of us, and we're celebrating together. To the Glass family and to the Khan family, thank you very much for the honor of sharing a few words of Torah. And I always need to say to Rabbi Stamfer, my teacher of so many years, the rabbi who I grew up with here at the synagogue, it's wonderful to see you in good health, and I look forward to talking Torah with you over the luncheon. Also, of course, Jacob. I don't want to lavish too much praise on him because last Shabbat afternoon, in a four-hour game of Risk, he eventually beat me. That game is about taking over the world. And actually, you know what? Let's all admit it. If we're going to hand the world, you know, the responsibility for the world to someone in this world, it's Jacob. I feel very confident with that. And I do have a few more words to share with you, so don't feel too left out. As an entry point to discussing this morning's Torah portion with you, Parshat Chukat, I want to return actually to a warm childhood memory of mine. Several of you, I'll be interested to see actually, share a similar memory. I'm taking us back to Camp Solomon Schechter, probably the late 1970s. The Chadar Ochel, I may be a year or two younger than Jacob, and I don't really know who's in charge of camp, because Gaga is the only thing that matters in my mind. But there's a rabbi who comes to visit on a pretty regular basis. I recognize him from my home synagogue, Neve Shalom. And whenever he visits, he's asked by the leadership of the camp to sing a particular song. And the camp goes crazy for it. Umoshe ikatsur bamateika sela. Sela. So many of you do share that memory. That's nice. The pre-bar mitzvah age Rab Khan has no idea what those words mean. But we're always singing Hebrew songs by heart without having any idea of what we're really saying. But in this case, rarely, the rabbi goes forward with some kind of strange dialect of English. Umoshe he hits the rock, meets the sticky hits the rock. Very poor. Meets the sticky hits the rock, and from the rock comes a vodka. I'm sure I had no idea what vodka was. I actually thought it was water. It wasn't funny. But years later, admittedly, because I was clueless, probably in rabbinical school, I make the connection that this song comes from a passage in the Torah. As an adult, I come to realize that this is a rich passage posing difficult questions, something I could have never imagined as a child listening to that song at camp. So now that we're adults, even Jacob is included, I want to invite you into that richness. Come and explore it with me for a few minutes, not too long, hopefully. And later, I hope to drive home this point that discovering or exploring Judaism is not for children. The real satisfaction and illumination that comes, it comes as an adult when we probe into the complexities of our tradition and eventually reveal its wisdom. So, I urge you to follow with me. Here's the background. The children of Israel are wandering through the wilderness after slavery in Egypt. They're on their way to the promised land. There's a shortage of water, as Jacob told us about, and the people complain. And obviously, without water, they're going to die. So So here's a little detail that we often miss. Two books ago, in the book of Exodus, they have this predicament of zero water, and God there commands Moshe to hit the rock with his staff. That's the song. But that detail is important. Hit the rock, and from that rock will come water. Moshe hits the rock in Exodus, and a miracle occurs. There's water for the children of Israel. Now we fast forward to today. Two books forward, to Bamidbar, to Numbers, the wilderness, our Parsha, Chukat. People are complaining. Moshe, why did you lead us into this wilderness? There's no food. There's no water for us to drink here. So Moshe and Aharon, in an immediate sign of humility, fall on their faces. And now, listen closely. I'm going to read directly from the text of our Parsha. You can follow along if you want, because we printed it for your convenience in the pamphlet. Everything's in the pamphlet. The presence of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "You and your brother Aharon, take the staff." Take the staff. It's the staff in the water routine. Take the staff and gather the community, and before their eyes, speak to the rock to bring forth water. Moshe took the staff from before the Lord as God had commanded him. Moses and Aaron assembled the congregation in front of the rock, and Moses said to the people, "Listen, you rebels, shall we get water for you out of this rock?" And Moshe raised his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their animals drank. It seems amazing, but the Lord said to Moshe and Aaron, "Because you did not trust me enough to affirm my sanctity in the sight of the Israelites, therefore you shall not lead this congregation. You're not going to lead this people into the land that I've given them." This part is so critical to understand. If you doze for a second, tune back in. Moshe, Aaron, because of what you just did, you are not going to enter into the promised land. Any questions about that? You got it? Rabbi Stanford's song, which caught the imagination of the entire camp, doesn't begin to address the tension, the tragedy, and the complexity of this story. There's lots of questions. There's tons of problems. But the biggest one that fascinates the Torah commentaries of time is this central question. Moses has dedicated his life loyally to leading the people of Israel from Egypt towards the promised land. And because of something that he just did, that's going to be taken away from him. He will not taste the land of milk and honey. He will remain on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So here's what I want to go from here. Fast. I want to review a few commentaries from our tradition. And to keep you involved, I'm going to ask you to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the commentary after I reveal it to you. Okay, I'll tell you, thumbs up, thumbs down. You with me? You can do that? Okay. So the question is, why is this punishment so grossly disproportionate? All of these come from Yeritz Chaim Chumash, so you can even review later. Rashi, France, 11th century. Pause and appreciate that. We often study what someone said from 900 years ago in France. He says, Moses struck the rock. You followed that detail? He was supposed to speak to it. Even though in that earlier episode he had hit the rock to bring water, here he was supposed to speak to it. What does it tell us? Good leaders need to listen closely. They need to be good listeners. In any case, Rashi claims that Moshe actually diminished the brilliance of the miracle by striking the rock, and for that he's punished. Thumbs up? Like that Rashi explanation? Most of you either aren't playing or you don't like it. That's a few more hands. That's good. Okay. Thumbs down. There were a lot of thumbs down. Rambam, 13th century Catalonia.
focuses on the line,
"Shall we get water for you out of this rock?" Moses and Aaron seem to be implying that they're the ones doing the miracle. That clearly crosses a line in this monotheistic religion of ours. And for that, they are punished. What do you think? Thumbs up. Oh, that one's popular. Okay. A lot of people like that one. Samson Raphael Hirsch, we jump forward many generations to Germany, 19th century. Moses was punished for losing his temper, something the rabbi alluded to last night. He called the people, "You rebels." And then he struck the rock not once, but twice. Good leaders don't lose their cool. For that, they are punished. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Okay. Rabbi Morris Adler, 20th century Detroit. I have a feeling, by the way, this is going to be popular here. Shout out to Detroit. The Torah is deliberately vague. This is an interesting take. We don't have the answer. The Torah doesn't want us to have the answer. The Torah is deliberately vague. We don't know the specific reason why leaders are punished, because the sins of the leaders are not necessarily blatant or obvious. Too many leaders seek the approval of the people by bending the truth. They lie so often that the public can't distinguish between what's a lie and what's the truth. They make judgments not based on what is true, but on how it will be received. What will my supporters say versus what is the right policy? So Rabbi Adler tells us that the Torah purposely leaves it wide open for our analysis and our interpretation. Now, the obvious take of the commentaries and where to go from here would be to talk about modern day leadership. My country is screwed up. Your country is screwed up. Let's just kind of leave it like that for now. And we can talk later at lunch over our leadership. I want to zoom out. You still with me? I want to zoom out for a moment and try to finish up, I guarantee you, to talk more about the experience we just had, studying a passage of the Torah and thinking about trying to answer perplexing questions that come out of the Torah. Our tradition encourages us to hold and honor many voices and many opinions, to engage in healthy discussion with varying opinions. By the way, I'm purposely not talking about Israel today, but Israelis do this really well. You can sit in a meeting with 8 people and they're all talking at the exact same time. That's the Israeli experience. If you ever come, get ready for it. Now, whether it was Rashi, Ramban, or Hirsch, all those different explanations were true. Each one was aware of what the person had said before him. And in Judaism, this is a constant emphasis. Think of the entire Talmud with all the rabbis who are in discussion with each other, even from different generations. Think about how we honor Sephardi and Ashkenazi customs, even though they're different. This tolerance and respect for plurality and pluralism is deeply embedded in our tradition. And this is so refreshing. I hope you'll agree with me. It's so counterculture. I don't have the time to discuss all the places our society refuses to see this, but you can think about religious fundamentalism. You can think about Fox News and MSNBC News. Singular voices, exclusive opinions, only one truth. So my dad always challenges me in every word of Torah that I speak, because years ago he said, "Okay, but how does this teaching affect our daily lives?" And I would say that we as a Jewish people have been called to be a light unto the nations. And this pluralism, plurality of voices comes from our tradition, and we should walk about proudly and share that with the rest of the world. The very last point I'm hoping to make is how our little quick analysis here of a passage from the Torah, which brought me back to our days at Camp Solomon Schechter, tells me that the education of Jewish youth is not enough, and sometimes we focus so much on it. This is a huge challenge to the Jewish community. Judaism is a thinking person's religion. It requires serious investment of time and intellectual faculties. It's not a tweet or a post or a picture that's going to fade in a few seconds. And this too is so counterculture today. It's so different because we have everything at our fingertips in this day and age. We expect immediate answers without very much effort. Now, it's very likely that I've preached to the choir today because you're all here. But think of the many adults who belong to the Jewish people who were abandoned at the age of 13 or 16 maybe without being given the privilege of learning on to their adult years. And so I have two kind of concluding little mentions here. One, I want to give a shout out to my mother, because whether this went well or not, I just need her to be pleased, and that's going to be fine. I made this trip to Portland, kind of an annual excursion, and I found out that not only is my mom kind of learning how to use her smartphone, she took her first selfie yesterday. She doesn't have many apps, but lo and behold, I found out that she has downloaded numerous podcasts about Torah. She's listening to Reform rabbis, conservative rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, the plurality of voices. And she won't go on a walk without first standing there and figuring out which Jewish podcast is she going to listen to. And she's a role model for all of us because of that. And finally, I want to go back to Jacob, okay? Bringing things all together, hopefully. Have you ever met anyone in your life who has such an unquenchable thirst for learning and is normal? Like, he's charming. I love hanging out with Jacob, despite the fact that he beat me in that game. Jacob understands what Torah Lishma is. He just wants to learn. And when he finishes watching all the documentaries in the world, he will get to Torah. I'm sure of it. And he too is going to be this great role model, even at such a young age, because he's so much beyond his age, of what it means to take the time to discover this tradition. And I believe that for him and for all of us, water, which is often compared with Torah, you can't go 3 days without drinking water. You can't go 3 days without hearing the Torah being read. I believe that Jacob eventually will discover this well of wisdom in Torah, and it will lead him and hopefully all of us into the promised land. Shabbat Shalom.